The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
One of the difficulties for me about going to reserve duty, you put yourself into a totally different mindset. A totally different environment. As a matter of fact, when you do it for a day, it's even more difficult because you kind of have to make this mental switch. You get up in the morning and you put on these green pajamas and you go out and you run in the fields and do whatever. And then the next, you come home at night and you sort of become a civilian human being again. But I remember the point at which it became clear to me what a different environment I was in. I was sitting, this was like the first or second year I was doing reserve duty. And I'm sure this was around when I was in regular army, but I wasn't as aware of it. And I was sitting with a bunch of guys, and everybody's like, you know, a doctor and a lawyer and a truck driver and a, you know, whatever people do, insurance salesmen and car salesmen. And it happened to be that the battalion that I was in, the guys that I was in charge of, were just an excellent group of guys. They were really an incredible bunch. And it was a pleasure to be with them. And I never, you know, I never had to run after them to do things, you know, for the most part. You had like one or two. Somebody had to be on guard duty, they were on guard duty. Somebody had to be on patrol, they were on patrol. And everybody was just willing to give when they had to set up Torah Nuyot and things like that, like you. So it was just easy. And they were just a quality group, and I was just getting so much out of spending time with them and appreciating a totally different perspective. People who were, you know, as we've mentioned in class, who considered themselves secular. I don't think being in the army is a secular act, but that's my opinion. And yet, you know, very ethical, magnificent people. So we're sitting around the table one day, we're talking. And they're telling stories, and I had like come in late. And all of a sudden I realized what they were talking about. And one of them was telling how, you know, he remembered when he was in the Sinai. And, you know, they would go down to the Sinai. You know, it was kind of like, it wasn't really reserve duty. It was like a vacation. Because you would do patrol in the Sinai. So you'd do patrol in the morning. And then you'd lie on the beach all afternoon. And another guy said, you know, yeah, as a matter of fact, you know, once when we were down by, you know, whatever, doing not far from Rifidim, near Nuevo, whatever. I don't know if you've ever been to Sinai, but it's incredible, right? And, you know, we were down there. And, you know, they asked who's leaving for Shabbat. And none of us raised our hands. We didn't want to get out for Shabbat. As a matter of fact, I called up my wife and I told her to bring the kids. And they came down and joined me. So I did a patrol in the morning and we had an afternoon on the beach. It was free. It was great. So the other guy looks at me and says, what are you, nuts? He says, bring my wife down to reserve duty? He said, forget it. Are you kidding me? This is my month off. You know, my wife gets a break. I get a break too. And I had a week with this girl, and I had a week with that girl, and I had a week with this girl. It was great. So the other guy is sitting, and he's saying, oh, yeah, that's true. Well, I remember when I was in whatever, you know, also I met this girl, and she was with Mara. She was a company clerk, whatever, you know, servicing the unit for whatever. So I took a little extra service. So I'm sitting there, and I'm listening to these discussions. You know, the young, little, naive Jewish boy, you know. And I'm saying, you know, I can't not say anything, right? I said, I don't get it. I said, didn't it? I mean, what would happen if your wife would find out? I mean, it's one thing, you know, somebody, but they're just talking about it and schmoozing and all the guys are sitting around, whatever. Thinking like, you know, if your wife found out, it would cause her so much pain, whatever. I said, why should she find out? I'm off on reserve duty. He says, I'm not even so sure it would bother her. But, you know, I'm not going to go tell her. But it's great. You know what? I came back from that that month of reserve duty. I was a better husband. I was recharged. You have to recharge the battery once in a while. So I recharged the battery. That's what the guy said. And I remember this just blew me away. Now you stop to think about it. What's wrong with that? I mean, what is this? Two words. Again, no explanation, no discussion, no name of God, just like yesterday. Just like murder. Just don't do it. Low. Tinaf. Don't commit adultery. Now what is that? What's wrong with adultery? Let's picture a perfect example. You know, there are certainly enough people in the world who are married and who stay married for the wrong reasons. I know someone who didn't really do his family a favor. And the couple, even though they were very unhappy together, stayed married for the children. And when the youngest son, who was actually coming to my yeshiva, was ready to leave for Israel, and he was finally leaving the home, they got separated. And, you know, I was supposed to get a letter from this son, you know, with a deposit, or whatever it was, the yeshiva program that I was running. I didn't get a letter from him. I waited a week or two, and then I ran into a friend of his. I said, you know, do you know if he's still coming? Do you know what's going on? He said, oh, you didn't hear? His parents got separated. I said, wow. The guy's 18 years old, his parents got separated. Very difficult, right? I met the boy, and I spent a year with him, learning with him. And I understood what a disservice, now, granted, this is just my perception, and it's not a black and white picture, and God forbid for me to judge them. I'm not judging them. That's not the issue here. But this boy was such an angry boy. He was so angry. So you can imagine situations where a person is married, and he doesn't really love his wife. And then he's walking down the street one day, and he meets someone, and he falls in love. And he just realizes this is the person he should be with. But he says, I can't do it. I can't do it to my children. So he has a relationship with her. He has an affair. And let's assume for the moment the wife never finds out. The wife never knows. Maybe this woman's married. Her husband never knows. When these two people are together, they make each other happy. And they have a wonderful relationship. And then whatever it ends. So who lost? Who lost from it? Who lost out? What is the big deal? I mean, what's wrong, essentially, with adultery? Now, understand that I will grant you that my perspective is a little different. Because I'm not saying, I'm not sitting on a law committee and saying, you know, should we forbid adultery? I'm not trying to figure out why the authors, but I'm saying that God has said objectively that this is wrong and I have to figure it out. But it's not so easy to figure it out. Is lying always wrong? We grow up with this, you know, I cannot tell a lie, cherry tree fib story. I'm not so sure that whole story isn't a lie, but okay. You know what, make it easier than that. I mean, this is really tomorrow's discussion. But if somebody walks over me here and says, you know, I just bought this dress, I can't take it back. Do you think I look pretty in it? So I can't lie. No, actually, that's the ugliest thing I've ever seen. Or I say, no, I think it's magnificent, it's beautiful, it's wonderful. So if I'm that person's fashion director, okay, but you know, so I lied. What's wrong with that?
I mean, it doesn't have to.
Yeah, but I'm just saying you could theoretically reach a stage where a lie would be a good thing.
I know.
Okay, well, we're going to have a discussion on falsehood. And I want you to remember this. Because I'm going to show you it doesn't have to be so extreme. Okay, we're going to see. I remember when I first discovered that you can actually lie. And not only can you actually lie, but sometimes halachically you're supposed to lie. There's a great movie with Alan Alda and Ellen Burstyn. It's called Same Time Next Year. Did you ever see this movie? It's a magnificent movie. Two incredible actors. They should have gotten, maybe they did, I don't know, Academy Awards. And he runs, he goes in this convention after a year, after a year that he's married or whatever it might be, and he runs into this woman. And he's stuck alone in this inn, and she's alone, she's stuck, I don't know, for whatever the reason. And so they say, you know what, this is silly. You know, you're sitting over there at that table, and I'm sitting over there at this table. Why don't we just sit together? At least we won't be alone. We'll have a nice conversation. And it begins very innocently. They fall in love. And the next year, he comes back to the same convention, and she's there. And they get into the habit. Every year on this weekend, or thereabouts, I don't know how you could every year on a certain weekend go lead your family and not have anybody notice something. But okay, whatever, maybe that's part of the problem. But okay, they get together. And so they have this relationship. So it's the analysis of a marriage-like relationship, which is founded on adultery. And they each follow each other's lives from afar as their children grow up and as they become grandparents and as they have illnesses and all these different things. And you know what? You look at this relationship, it's a beautiful relationship. And eventually, the man's wife dies and now he's alone and his children are all grown up. And he's still in love with her. And now he wants to marry her. And of course, because life is real, it doesn't work. And what's wrong with that relationship? Now, you may be right. It may be that the adulterous relationship will lead to other things. Okay, lying. Talmud says that one of the reasons why it follows murder is because one leads to the other. You know, the husband finds out his wife is cheating, and we've all heard these crimes of passion, etc. But then what you're saying is that adultery itself is not so bad, it's just that it leads to something else, which is bad. Now, that's a legitimate point. But is that really what the Torah is telling me? In other words, if you theoretically, you know, you could argue that I don't know whether a given action of mine is objectively good or evil until I die. Because when I die, I can look back and say it was good. And it's like I give a person advice. So I don't know if that advice is good, but at the end of days, it'll have been good or not good. So if, theoretically, you have an adulterous affair, and it's the only adulterous affair you ever have, and it's magnificent, and you're all depressed, maybe you want to kill yourself, and then you meet this woman, and you have an adulterous affair, and because of that, you go on, and you have a good life, and it's incredible, and it's wonderful, and it gives to you, and it gives to her, and it's a memory you cherish forever, so what's wrong with it? Nobody can leave this class until we finish this discussion, right? Right? So what's wrong with it? Caught the beginning of class, great class, you know? I mean, what's wrong with it? This is a problem. And we have to figure this out. The definition of adultery, in some ways, is a little easier than our definition of murder, at least initially. What is your definition of adultery? Let's say in the classical sense, as the Bible is discussing it. Yes?
A breach of trust.
No, you're giving me the underlying theme behind adultery. What act? In other words, if somebody walks out of this room, right, finds someone, has a magnificent relationship. You're not married, they're not married. So whether there are other halakhic problems is an interesting question, but it's not adultery, right? If you sleep with a dog, so the Bible says you're not allowed to sleep with a dog. And it's amazing to see it in there because it must mean that people actually did this. And today there are people who sleep with animals. There's a term for it. So it may be removed from us, but it's not adultery. What's the definition of adultery? You are having a relationship in which you deny the relationship you already have. In other words, if I have a relationship with a married woman, and that woman is not married to me, that's adultery. Okay, that's the classical definition, right?
Does it mean
sexual relationship? A sexual relationship. In other words, the biblical consummation. For example, if I find a married woman, I fall in love with her, and I take her away for a magnificent weekend in Acapulco, and we stay in the same room, but for whatever reason, I don't know, I get a virus. And I'm sick all week. So we don't actually do anything, but we're alone in the bed, whatever, chas v'shalom. So I haven't actually biblically committed adultery. I've committed a whole host of other things. And I would say that, you know, I need to re-examine whether I'm in the right job, but essentially I haven't. So when you consummate the relationship physically, so that's the definition of adultery. Okay. All right. And of course, and I know you've discussed this with Rebecca, with Mrs. Rubenstein, so the end of the Ten Commandments is, how do I avoid getting to that stage? So that's, don't covet. Because that's going to get you to the other ones. Okay. And that really is a defining factor for all of the other 9 commandments. But okay. But so that's adultery, right? Now there are different kinds of adultery. It's interesting. And I won't go as in-depth as I did yesterday because I want to get to a point that I know we won't get to now, right? But the most obvious is I can adulter on God. Which is why this is the 7th commandment, and it corresponds to the 2nd commandment, opposite it on the other tablet, which is, you know, idolatry. And idolatry really is a form of spiritual adultery. I can adulter on myself, if you think about it. If I have a relationship, and I allow myself to be removed from that relationship, whatever that relationship might be, because I'm swayed by another relationship, that may be less legitimate, is that adultery? It's a very interesting question. How far does adultery go? And in line with the discussion that we've had about the Ten Commandments being a sort of recipe that will allude to all the other issues, ethical, spiritual, moral, in the Torah, so you can imagine how far you can take adultery, right? If adultery means that I have committed myself to a relationship, and I am now defying that commitment by virtue of another relationship, so you can imagine how easy it would be to adulter, for example, if I have a business partner, and I commit myself to a business partner, and then I develop a relationship with another business partner. And let's say I do it in a very legal sense, right? I have a contract with you, and I have a contract with him. Is that a form of adultery? Was my original business relationship understood to be exclusive? So you can imagine that this could lead in all sorts of directions, but I don't think you need me, and I think you know, it's pretty clear where this could go. And by the time we finish this discussion, the concept behind adultery is a concept which can involve you in its everyday. And I want to tell you, for me, the reason that I say this is because the most difficult part for me about adultery was, do I need this mitzvah? Now, don't get me wrong. You know when you've really beaten sin? You know when you've really conquered your desire? In the grave. And until you get there, it ain't over till it's over. So what I say now, I realize, is an absurd thing to say. But I'll be honest with you. There's certain transgressions that concern me, that are difficult, and I struggle with them daily. I don't know, slander. Not to speak lashon hara. So this is a dilemma that I constantly have when somebody is sitting with me and they're discussing a story. What am I allowed to hear? What am I not allowed to hear? What am I allowed to say? What am I not allowed to say? Very difficult questions. Adultery in the classical sense is not high on my mind. I don't really think that I'm going to meet some woman at a bus stop and I'm going to be swept up by the passion of the moment and take her off to some motel. It's not high on my list. Not that you can ever know what will happen in your future life. You know, and not to say that you shouldn't take safeguards. You know, there's a big discussion. You'll notice that in the religious world, there are a lot of men who don't wear wedding rings. A lot of people don't wear wedding rings. Now, there's no halachic problem with wearing wedding rings, but there were some who suggested that a wedding ring was a custom that didn't have its origins in Judaism, etc., that men wearing jewelry might not be proper. All sorts of discussions. Most of the authorities actually say, no, you're allowed to wear a wedding ring. Not a problem. It's interesting that the custom of wearing a wedding ring dates back almost 1600 years, at least that we know of. But you don't have an obligation to wear a wedding ring. By the way, a woman doesn't have an obligation to wear a wedding ring either. She has an obligation to receive some item from the groom at the wedding, but what she does with it is up to her, right? She can give it away afterwards, although that would give one pause. However, I decided to wear a wedding ring. Why did I decide to wear a wedding ring? Because especially when I was first married, I remember the first time I went to Milwaukee. You know, and you can always tell a new husband, you know, who's wearing a wedding ring. He's kind of like, yep, uh-huh, yep. And it was just for me a boundary. It's like, now I'm different. Now there's something different. I'm a married man. And there's a way that you behave. And we all do this all the time. There's certain things that we do as human beings. They've become so much a part of us, we're not even aware of them. Flirtatious behavior, whatever it is. There's a certain line you don't cross once you're married. Right? I'll give you an example. Well, okay, right? So, no, not that I've brought with the example. I just want to get to the point, right? Okay? If you're curious what the example was, you asked me, right? So, but I remember especially when I went to Milwaukee, that I really valued the wedding ring. Because there's a certain looseness that automatically comes when you're walking out in patrol with a gun, that you're not concerned sometimes with the ethical and moral questions that you should be on a regular basis, which is probably why the story that I told you originally came to be, right? So the fact that I have a wedding ring reminds me, you know, you're a married man. Okay. So therefore, do I really need this commandment, and what does this commandment mean? So, let's take a look at this. What is really wrong with adultery? When you think about it, adultery is really a physical act. And the real challenge should be not what's wrong with the physical act, but is there some spiritual, moral implication behind the physical act? And can I distance myself from that? In other words, if I can commit this physical act without the spiritual issue that we may discover, so then really the physical act shouldn't be a problem. Can I do that, and is that so? So let's take a look at this. What is adultery? You want to say something? Okay. What do I want when I commit adultery? I want sex. That's at least one level of adultery. It's not so simple, right? What else could I want when I develop a comfort, companionship? You know, I want you to know, it's easy for us, it's so easy in life to judge others. It's so difficult to learn not to. And, you know, I know that there was a case of someone, whatever, in the religious community who, they had a divorce, and it was a terrible, terrible story. And, you know, I don't remember, he had an affair, she had an affair, whatever. And you can imagine that in a religious community like Efrat, where this is such a rarity, so, you know, people discussed it and whatever. And I, you know, tried as hard as I could to distance myself from the issue, but you also have to think about the other side of it. In other words, if a person's in a bad marriage, I can't imagine how lonely that must be. I mean, how lonely that must be. Who do you talk to? Because normally you don't air that type of dirty laundry. So maybe someone found comfort and a willing ear in someone else's arms. So it's not just about sex. So why do I say it's about sex? Well, very simply, Because if what you're looking for is companionship and a willing ear, you don't have to commit adultery to do it. There are halachic ways, whether it's desirable, not desirable, interesting question, but there are halachic ways to have a relationship with a woman without committing adultery. I mean, I took a ride in with Mrs. Rubenstein this morning. We got stuck in the rain, right? And we had an interesting discussion about the class she was going to teach. So ultimately, in order to transgress the violation of adultery, I have to commit a sexual act. So therefore, in getting down to the root of it, the essence of the prohibition is the sexual act. So it may be that you get into the sexual act because you need companionship, and that you view that as part of it. What the Bible is saying is that part of it isn't something you should be involved in. So that's why we have to take a look specifically at the sexual act of adultery and see what that is. Because that's the root of the prohibition, even if a person may think it's not the root of the relationship. So why do I want sex? Why does a person want sex? There are really three reasons a person wants sex. What are they? You wanted to say something? No? Okay, so there are two components you're saying to adultery. One is that it's a sexual act. And the other is that that sexual act is done in an improper framework, right? That's what you're saying. So I agree with you. So let's first look at the sexual act, and then let's see what the problem is with the framework. In other words, there are certain instances where I can have a sexual act, and it's not only permissible, but it's desirable in the Torah. But first I have to see what the sexual act is before I can figure out what it is about this particular framework that's problematic. So let's see. Why do I want sex? Well, there are three basic reasons that a person wants sex. Now, one is to reproduce, because that's the method that we're given biologically by God to create life. And if a person is married and wants to have a child, right, so they have to have sex. They have to have relations. And therefore, that relationship, that sexual relationship, can be very much about wanting to produce life. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is to satisfy your physical needs, right? In other words, the issue is not about reproducing. As a matter of fact, very often, not always, but often in this context, there's actually, especially in today's society, an attempt to ensure that the second is there without the first. I don't want to reproduce. I don't want to have a child. I want to have birth control. I want to be sure that, you know, protection for other reasons, but so that's the second. What's the third? So this is very interesting. Very interesting. Because it's very hard, I think you're right, we have to define what that is. It's very hard to be able to define what this third is that's different from the other two. There are two parts to the human being. And we're going to get into this when we discuss kashrut. There is the physical and the spiritual. There is the part of me that strives to reach God. But there is a part of me that is very much a part of the earth. There is a part of me that is man elevated above, and there is a part of me that is animal below. Every part of me reflects the tension between these two different leanings, tendencies, parts of my existence. And this is no exception. So the sexual act can very much be about reproducing, creating life, about elevating myself above, let's say, the physical alone, but it can also be almost about the animal nature within me. Now that's different from satisfying my desires, even though they're very much related, because one can be about pleasure, and the other can be about power, control. It's very interesting. When I was in Pittsburgh, so I took this, I was studying whatever, for a long time I used to study karate, and I found this master who was teaching jujitsu, and I always wanted to try a different discipline, and it opened my eyes. It was magnificent to discover how two different disciplines came at the same idea from completely different directions. And, karate is all about meeting force with force, and jujitsu is all about using the force that comes at you and letting it pass by, right? Et cetera, et cetera. So, this particular person, a guy named Curtis Smith, huge, 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 huge guy, who was the head of security at Pitt University, And he was like a black belt, and he had been a Marine, and he had been this whatever fullback or something, whatever chvaisnish back on the football team. And he had hurt his knee, but he was going to be a big college football star. I mean, anyway, so he determined at a certain point that there was a big problem with rape in Pittsburgh. There still is, and a lot of the college students are having to deal with this. And the problem was that, you know, karate or jiu-jitsu or any martial art can teach a person to deal with these issues. But if you go to a karate class, it'll take you years before you can apply what you learn enough that it can really help you respond to this type of an issue. And even jiu-jitsu, which perhaps takes a lot less time, you know, so you need a couple of years to really become proficient enough that you could handle yourself in a given situation, depending on the student. And a college student didn't have that. They'd come for a semester, they'd come. So he developed this course, and he would teach this course in 6 weeks. It was called Bayam, Buy Yourself a Minute. And it was brilliant. And he was looking for people that he could train to do this, to go and teach this, etc. And I thought, this is a magnificent opportunity to really learn something. And I learned a lot from it in terms of how to educate and how to teach. So I did this, and I became whatever, you know, you get this little piece of paper, whatever. And I started teaching this. And in order to do this, I had to do a lot of reading. I thought I was going to go and he was going to teach me all these different perceptions and moves and how you can teach somebody a physical instinct in a certain amount of time. No, first I had to do a tremendous amount of reading. And I read a lot of reports on what rape is and how the psychology of it works, etc. And one of the things I discovered was that the consensus very much is that rape is not a sexual act. Rape is very much about control. It's an act of violence. It's an attempt to take what you feel you can't be given. And what it is that you're taking isn't always the physical act. That's very often symbolic of things that are much deeper. So those are the three things that sex can be. It can be a desire to reproduce, to bring life into the world. It can be a desire to satisfy my physical needs, right? And it can be a desire to take control. Now that's very interesting. If this is so, and tell me at any point if you disagree with me, well, now it gets interesting. Because the truth is that this is a paradigm for almost every other physical expression in this world. Because there are two parts to any act. There is the actual act, and there is the thought process, the motivation behind the act. And one of the tremendous things of, I think, any religious system is that it attempts to give meaning to those physical acts. And the difference very often between something being desirable, positive, and something being negative is quite simply not the act itself, but the motivation behind it. In other words, if I'm eating a pork sandwich and you see me eating a pork sandwich, I could be transgressing or I could be fulfilling a mitzvah. Now the transgressing part is obvious, but how could I be fulfilling a mitzvah? Okay, well give me an example of how I would save somebody's life by eating a pork sandwich.
If you had been starving, you hadn't eaten.
Yeah, if I'm starving, if I'm sick, if I find out that I have some kind of a, God forbid, a heart condition, and that I need to eat pork. And by the way, this is a very, very practical question, and there are halachic responsum regarding this question, because cardiovascular conditions very often require certain types of medicine that use pig meat. The pills that you take for the heart very often come from animal extracts and sometimes pigs. And there was a question asked of Moshe Feinstein, do you have an obligation as a heart patient to attempt to find pills that are kosher? And the answer is very interesting. In other words, clearly a guy is clutching his heart on the subway and he has pills, or someone offers him pills that are made of pig meat. So that's obvious. I mean, you know, that's pikuach nefesh, that's the essence of Torah, that we, you know, that life is a gift, and kashrut does not come before life, and therefore obviously you'll take those pills. But now I know that I have a cardiovascular condition. Do I have an obligation to go find kosher pills? Let's assume kosher pills are more expensive. Let's assume it's harder to get them. Let's assume it's just, you know, my doctor gave me these, and I went and got the prescription, then I realized, do I have to go get it? Rav Moshe gives an unbelievable answer. It's an incredible answer. Don't anybody come to a halachic ruling based on this class, because it's much more complicated. This is the way I perceive Rav Moshe's answer, but a posik would go back and read it again and look at it and consider it, and am I right? The halacha says an unbelievable thing. And I'm making a point here, which is why I'm telling you this. But the halacha says an unbelievable thing. The halacha says that, obviously, if a person is drowning on Shabbat, So you have to jump in to save them, even though that may be somehow a transgression of Shabbat. Right? In other words, my saving life comes before Shabbat. Then the halacha goes a stage further. Maimonides discusses this. The code of Jewish law rules this way, which is the father of our system of halachic ruling. If there's a group of people who see someone drowning, who should save him? It's a weird question. What do you mean, who should save him? Whoever can save him. What do you mean? No, there's a group of people. So the Rambam says, the Talmud Chacham Shebahem, the greatest Torah scholar is the one who should save him. Now, when you think about it, it's a very strange statement. The greatest Torah scholar should save the person who's drowning. I mean, whoever can jump faster. What the Rambam means to say, the Orso Meir, Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, explains that what the Rambam really means to say there, Maimonides, is that if he's really a Torah scholar, if the Torah is somehow more imbued within him because he knows more, then the way that I know he's a Torah scholar is that he ends up being the one who saves him. Because if he hesitates, it's Shabbos, should I, you know, it's a very serious issue, transgression of Shabbat. Shabbos, save life. In other words, it should be so part of you, the value of human life, that of course you jump in. And the Rambam goes on. Anyone who hesitates, anyone who attempts, you know, to ask a non-Jew to do it or anything like that, is guilty. Right? And mitchayev benafsho, it's as though he's worthy of being killed. Because he will cause people to hesitate in a life-threatening situation. And therefore, Rav Moshe says, you should not, you actually should not attempt to find other medicine, because this is a life-threatening disease. And if you do, people will think that really you shouldn't take this, and it will cause someone somewhere to hesitate to take heart pills, and perhaps someone's life will be forfeit because others have attempted to find. And he even said we'd be better off not developing kosher heart medicine if there's unkosher heart medicine there, although he doesn't give that as a ruling. So that's an unbelievable idea. So I see someone eating something that I know to be of pig extract, and he might be fulfilling a mitzvah as part of a whole halachic process, based on studying Rav Moshe Feinstein's responsum, in order to save not just my life, but other lives. So obviously the act is very much involved with the motivation behind it, which makes, of course, our question all the more difficult. Because that's not what the Torah says. The Torah says, don't adulter. If you sleep with another woman, and she's married, then you've committed an adulterous act. And as a matter of fact, in this particular instance, there is no motivation given for making it permissible, because even if my life is at stake, I'm not allowed to do it. So it seems to me, now this is just opinion, and you can take it or leave it, but it seems to me I've now given you the ingredients for coming up with a solution. If the meaning of an act is very much a part of the act itself, and here I have an act which I say is always a problem, what does that lead me to conclude? You understand my question? I'll ask it again. If in Judaism I don't judge an act merely on the act itself, but I need the purpose, the motivation, the meaning behind the act in order to determine whether that act is desirable or not. So the fact that here in adultery, I've automatically assumed that this act is not desirable, what does that tell me? It tells me that I'm automatically assuming that the motivation is not desirable. I mean, that seems to me to be a logical sequence. So let's see if that's true. Okay? And now we're getting very much into the world of opinion. What do you think, based on what I've said so far, would lead me to conclude that? Well, it's very simple. I've got three possibilities for what a sexual act involves so far. Unless you come up with another one, there may well be another one. I've just, you know, in trying to break it down, to reproduce, to gratify my physical need, or to find some form of control. Well, if I'm satisfying an emotional need, and that may well be.
See, I mean, I don't understand how control covers suddenly like all emotional needs. I mean,
no.
Because there's definitely a third.
No, in other words, for example, let's say I'm lonely.
Right.
So I say I'm having sex because I'm lonely.
Right.
Okay, but when you really stop to analyze it, is that really true?
Because
in other words, the sex is not going to help me with my loneliness, ultimately. In fact, sometimes having sex is going to make you more lonely. What I really need to resolve the issue of my loneliness, right, is something completely different that very often comes along with sex. And I'm confusing the two. The intimacy, the relationship, the communication that very often is surrounding that sexual act is what I really need. So I don't really need the sexual act to solve my aloneness. That's what I'm saying. But when it comes to control and power and domination, that could be something that I fulfill with a sexual act. This is, by the way, not me. This is, I mean, there are a number of different psychoanalysts that describe this. Oh, I'm not saying that the act is me. No, you could also say I'm not really going to be physically gratified. But there is a certain gratification. Again, if you want to call it the satisfying emotional need, I'm willing to accept it. I've never found, in other words, it seems to me that there's a major difference in terms of what motivates people. You know, it's an interesting question. You don't really find cases. I mean, you'll find the rare case which makes the newspapers when they don't have enough news to fit their print, whatever, right? But for the most part, you don't really find cases of women raping men. You find cases of men raping women. So there are two theories as to this, right? Going back to that stuff I read. One is a practical theory. Because for a man can rape a woman, essentially, against her will. In other words, if you're talking about the consummation of rape, right? Not all the other things that could also be called rape. So a man can rape a woman against her will because he enters her and he commits a sexual act, even though she doesn't want him to. A woman theoretically can't commit an act of rape against his will because he has to be aroused. So that's one theory. But that doesn't really do it, because then you would find a lot of women trying to rape men and not succeeding. It's not like women want to rape men and then they think about it, they say, well, it won't work, so they don't do it. It's just that women don't do it. So the other theory, which seems to me to make more sense, although I realize that with a theory it's not proven and it's not, you know, you don't know that it's right, but it just sits well with me, it's like, is that there's something about rape that very much is involved in the psychological makeup of a man that you don't find as much in the psychological makeup of a woman. And we know that the psychological makeup of men and women is very, very different, Baruch Hashem, right? And this may be one particular area where you can find an example of such a difference. And when you look at studies that are done, psychological studies and sociological studies, it always comes down to this issue, to power and control. In other words, I started out from a very different assumption when I was coming up with what these three things were. I was saying, well, what are the examples of rape? Well, what are the examples of sex? Well, I find sex within a relationship of marriage, sex out of relationship of marriage, and sex and rape. Those seem to me to be the three issues. Molestation we'll call rape as well, right? So it seemed to me, therefore, when I defined those three possibilities, that those three possibilities always came down to these. But I could be wrong. But now looking at these three, and let's then add the addendum that beyond this somehow power trip, this animal instinct to control and to conquer, and the fact that man seems to somehow want to conquer woman, and woman at least physically does not seem to want to conquer man somehow, right? Even though sometimes they do, right? That you want to add to that the fact that man uses sex as the attempt to fulfill some emotional need. Now I would just add that if that's the case, that's also probably some kind of a self-gratification. But okay, maybe power is as well.
The question is, why do you want
I didn't describe men and women. I just said, when we look at sex, so what do I find are the motivating factors behind the actual physical act? So I said these are the three that we seem to find. I agree that this third one seems to apply more to men. I definitely think that's true. And I think also that it's fair to say what men and women need, different things in a relationship and different things out of a physical relationship. And it may well be they discovered an unbelievable thing. Very, very important. Because what you're analyzing is the idea behind the mitzvah, the idea behind the concept. And I'll give you one particular example. One of the things that very often upsets people who sort of begin to develop a relationship with, let's say, the Jewish religious system, whatever that means, right? And I very often, you know, someone will ask me this question. Well, why are there all these limitations on women and there are no limitations on men? Now, that happens not to be true, but let's say it's a perception. It certainly is true, right? And very often the issue is, well, why does the woman dress a certain way in relationship to a man? And it's interesting to note, without going too deep into this, because this is a good discussion for question and answer, but it's interesting to note that the woman, right, and the man, in other words, what's the idea behind this? That theoretically, if a woman walks around in a miniskirt, let's say, so she's getting a man all excited, right, let's say, theoretically, right? And therefore, she shouldn't wear that because, you know, she should take into account the fact that the man will get excited. So the obvious response to that is, but it's ridiculous. I mean, if a man is going to get excited and he's going to have some kind of a problem with that, then he should have the problem. Why should the woman have the problem? So one of the differences between men and women, and the reflection of this particular series of system, not that anybody should assume they understand it from this discussion, is exactly this issue. Is that psychologically, sociologically, and sexually, men and women are very different. Just as an example, there's a biblical prohibition against a man masturbating. Right? It's called shichvat zera levatala, that you're spilling your seed in vain. There is no biblical prohibition. There may be a rabbinic one, but there's no biblical prohibition against a woman masturbating, very simply because when a man spills seed in vain, the potential for life is lost. When a woman spills juices in vain, so that's not the potential for life. That's, you know, a lubricate. It's a whole different idea. And therefore, the man has the potential in a situation like that to come to a biblical prohibition, and the woman doesn't. But the reason that there are different prohibitions is very much bound up in the fact that men and women have very different psychological makeups. And that's also a part of this. So I'm willing to accept that. Now, having said, and by the way, this relates to this commandment in another way that I'm not going to get to, because I will really not get to where I want to get to, which is the fact that at least biblically, someone here pointed out that this was speaking specifically to the fact that a man was committing adultery with a married woman. Now, a man biblically had the opportunity to marry more than one woman. So therefore, if a man wanted to have a relationship, and he was married, with a woman who wasn't married, so it would be easy for him to have such a relationship and not consider it adultery, right? Now, how that works and how it works sociologically and why it was actually meant to be for the benefit of women and not for the benefit of men is an interesting question. And that a man couldn't commit such a relationship and we won't get into the question, but realize that that question is also very much a part of this issue. So if this mitzvah raises that issue for you and you're curious about it, so again, when we get a chance to sit and talk, b'simcha we'll discuss it. But getting back to the question of adultery. So what is it about the physical act that makes it objectively problematic? Even though, essentially, I keep saying, it's the motivation behind the physical act that seems to be important. So when I look at these possibilities for what can lie behind the sexual act, the Torah seems to be saying that they have a desired motivation. That they're not interested in some of these other motivations. And God says essentially that the act of sex is not an objective. It's not a goal. It's a means. And whether or not that act is acceptable within Judaism seems to be determined by whether that goal is acceptable. And therefore, if that's so, there's only one goal here that the Torah seems to desire. And that's the act of reproducing. In other words, if my sexual act is a part of my attempt to create life, to give, to bring into the world, well, then it's a part of love, and it's a part of marriage. If my sexual act is a part of gratification, of whatever type of gratification, in other words, it's really not giving, it's really taking, then that's problematic. That's really the nutshell definition for adultery. Now this becomes very, very interesting. Because when I begin to look at what adultery really is, what the Torah is telling me is exactly what we were saying yesterday. What makes something ethical or unethical? Well, that really is based on who gives me the ethic. It's really based on what I'm doing here and what all my actions are involved in. And if my actions somehow have a higher purpose, they're not about me. They're about something beyond me, then every part of my world, my physical world, and all of my actions should also be very much beyond me. And that's why adultery per se is a problem. Because the definition of the act is always that it involves me, and it's not beyond the me. And it's interesting that adultery always affects, whether they know it or not, the potential for taking from someone else. One of the Talmudic discussions is why lo tignov, why theft follows adultery. Because when you adulter somehow, the potential for theft is there as well. Not just in terms of the fact that you're stealing, let's say, someone else's wife, but that you're stealing the affection that that wife has to give to that person. That you're stealing the relationship that can be damaged by virtue of that adulterous act. That you're stealing the relationship that the children can have with the parents. It's very interesting. Some of the commentaries get into practicality, right? In other words, from a practical perspective, can there be points at which practically there's a problem with adultery. So I saw a couple of very interesting commentaries. One of the commentaries said, well, if you have adultery, then there's always the danger that the woman gives birth and no one knows who the father is, which means that you're denying a child their father. And then it was very interesting that there were two opinions as to what that resulted in. One opinion was that child doesn't have the possibility of fulfilling the mitzvah of kibbut av v'em, of respecting their father at least, which is just an incredibly different perspective. That I wouldn't adulter because there might be a child who can't fulfill the mitzvah. The other possibility is that the potential for incest exists. Because if we have a child and the child doesn't know who their father is, then the child can't ever be 100% sure, when you think about it, that they're not ending up getting married to their brother or sister, which is a fascinating issue. And as a matter of fact, there's another halachic response that questions whether in a case like that, and the only way I found this, I had a student who became very close with, a boy from England, and he confided in me eventually that, you know, because I knew there was a whole story with his family and his father had left his mother. Turned out that his mother had been raped. And he was, and he didn't know this whole story. He always thought that his father had left his mother and he wasn't Jewish and they didn't care about him and they didn't know. And she finally confronted him and explained to him the whole story because he really wanted to know his father and he wanted to know the details. And his mother had been raped and she didn't know who the guy was. This boy didn't know who his father was. So now he was very much in love with a girl and he had a very halachic dilemma. How did he know that this girl wasn't his brother or sister? I mean, so obviously the probability of it was, you know, but she was a girl from England. How did he know? So I really didn't know what to do, and I went to a couple of rabbis and we looked up some responses. A very difficult question. And the big question was not whether he could marry the girl, but whether he had an obligation to do some sort of a DNA test. And in the end, he didn't, whatever, right? But the idea of the implication of an adulterous act. Okay, now let me say just one more thing, and then I want to give you an example. I'll give you an extreme example. This is obviously a subject that touches home for a lot of us. So I wouldn't have this discussion on the first day of the program. And I assume by now you all realize, God forbid, that, you know, I don't judge individuals by what they do, and I don't judge individuals. You know, everybody has to consider their own surrounding and their own life and how that works and everything else. Fair enough. But, you know, it's very easy to say, I don't know, take for example the issue of, I don't know, premarital sex, which is, you know, it's today in our society become less of an issue. In the, you know, certainly traditional Jewish perspective, it still is very much an issue, but okay. Well, aside from, well, the halacha tells me it's problematic, right? What's wrong with premarital sex? Is there a problem with premarital sex? So I once had this discussion with a girl, and we were having a long discussion about this, and because we were already at a stage where she knew that I wasn't judgmental, but she was really asking me why I, because when I got married, I had, Baruch Hashem, never had relations with another woman, right? So what's the need, what's the necessity of that? And I remember she was saying that there aren't there certain practical issues, like isn't it valuable to gain from different experiences? I went out, I went on dates and had relationships with lots of different girls. I mean, not lots, but, you know, with different girls before I got married, and I learned a lot. I think I'm a better husband for it. So couldn't that be true with the physical act? I said, well, here's an interesting question. Let's say, and I realize that this is very much oversimplification and very much a black and white issue, which is absurd. So I use it just as an example. So don't say, well, what if? I mean, that's ridiculous, because it's a ridiculous example. But I'll give it to you anyway. Right? Imagine that a man and woman are having a relationship, a physical relationship, and the woman gets pregnant. So now the woman has to decide what to do. And you know, this is a real issue, I think, and I personally think that it's an issue that a woman should always consider, because there is no such thing as 100% proof birth control. It doesn't exist yet. They may discover it, but it doesn't exist yet. Right? So what does a woman do? Well, she's got two options. She can choose to abort or she can choose to have the child. Both are legitimate options and they're her options. And if a person chooses to abort, then it's understandable why the halakha has a problem with that sort of an issue, because the halakha may have a certain problem with abortion. And therefore, perhaps it would be understandable to say, whether you agree with it or not, that before a person enters a relationship, they should have decided that they really are interested in the life that may result. If a person chooses to have a child, right? And I think, by the way, the question is equally as big for the man as it is for the woman. Because the man has to decide, is he going to take a certain responsibility? So then the woman has essentially said, I'm willing to take responsibility for a life that results. And the only difference between deciding that premarital sex is okay and premarital sex isn't, is when you make that decision, do you make that decision before you have a sexual relationship or after? If you choose to make that decision beforehand, if there's a life, that I'm going to take responsibility for that life. So Judaism calls that marriage. That's all. It's a very simple equation. Now, of course, it's not a simple equation. And I've just made a very complex question, very black and white. But that very much relates to adultery. What is the motivating factor behind the physical act? You know, when I sit down to the table, I wash my hands before I eat bread. What does that mean, that I wash my hands before I eat bread? It means that I'm about to commit a physical act, and I want to give meaning to that physical act. So I want to give pause. I want to think about it. I want to understand what it is I'm doing. I want to give something from within me to relate to what I'm doing without me. And that's exactly the same issue. What is a physical act? What is the potential for the creation of human life? What is the potential for a relationship that can develop from a physical act? How much can two people grow together? How much can two people give to each other? How much can two people learn from each other? What sort of a relationship can develop from such a physical act? Comes along Judaism and says that's a tremendous thing. It's a gift. And that gift, that relationship, that beauty is a part of what Judaism calls marriage. That's the challenge. Now I'm going to give you a specific example. Look at an unbelievable story. Look in Genesis in chapter 39. This is an unbelievable story. It's an unbelievable story because when you really stop to consider it, it's hard to imagine being in this situation and succeeding in such a fashion. So who are we talking about here? We're talking about Joseph. It's interesting that there's only one individual in the entire Bible who is called Tzaddik in the Bible. That is who? Does anybody know? Who is called Tzaddik? Noah. Not Abraham, not Isaac, not Jacob, Noah. Who technically was a non-Jew. Very interesting. He's the only person in the Bible who is ever called a tzaddik. There is only one other individual. Only one. Okay? There's only one other individual who is called a tzaddik by tradition. Right? From the Bible. There's a third from the period of the Mishnah, Shimon HaTzaddik, and that's Joseph. Joseph is called a tzaddik, Yosef HaTzaddik. Now this is interesting. Because we're going to take a look at the why. What it is that caused tradition to call Yosef a tzaddik. And I want you to know, you would think, if I could think of actions that would make me a tzaddik, I don't know, tremendous study of Torah. Heightened and developed relationship with God. Well, I know that's not true because Moshe's never called a tzaddik. Tremendous ethic. Well, Avram's not called a tzaddik. So what is it that causes this person to be a tzaddik? Very interesting. Look at this story. We're in verse 7. Joseph has been sold by his brothers into slavery. He's a slave in Egypt. You don't get much lower than being a slave in Egypt. He's not a Hebrew slave, which the Bible implies to me in a number of points, junctures, that this was the lowest of the caste system of the slave groupings in Egyptian society. Right? To be a Hebrew slave, whatever that means. You know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were already known in Egypt. Abraham had been down to Egypt. He had a relationship with the Pharaoh of Egypt. Okay? So look at this story. Vayehi acharat v'imeilin. And it was after these things, right? After this whole story of, you know, being, he was in a house, and he was a slave, and Potiphar, the master of the house, takes Joseph into his confidence, recognizes that there's something special, that this boy has potential and unique ability, and he elevates him in the system within his house, and he's a minister to the king, until Joseph becomes like sort of the master of ceremonies, the aide-de-camp, as it were, of Potiphar, which is a tremendous level to achieve for a slave. Vatisa eshet adonav eteneah el Yosef. So the wife of his master casts her eyes upon Joseph. This is very interesting. I mean, you can already guess, because of the topic, and because of the first verse, what's going to happen here, and what dilemma we're going to face, but let's see. Okay? Vatomer shichva imi. And she says, sleep with me. Vayima'ein. Very powerful word. And he refuses. Okay? What's the word in English? How do they translate it? He refused. Okay. Vayomer aleshet adunav. And he says to the wife of his master. By the way, I want you to note, when we talk about her, what's missing. Okay? Her name. We don't name her. Because the issue here is not just so much who she is, but that she's the wife of his master. Now that's, on the one hand, the reason not to sleep with her. On the other hand, it's a reason to sleep with her. When you think about it. I mean, there's a whole strata of society in Washington and all over the world that considers the sexual relationship you develop as an in, as it were. And you can get the movie part by having a physical relationship. And you can be brought up before the board by having a physical relationship. And you can advance yourself at work by having a physical relationship. And all sorts of other things. So it's very interesting that this is the relationship that's being given to us. So he refuses. And he says to her, "Hein aduni lo yadaiti ma babayit." Verse 8. My master doesn't know what I'm doing here. And yet, v'chol asher yesh lo natan v'yeti, he's given me everything. Everything he's given me. Einenu gadol b'vayit hazeh mimeni. There is no one higher in this household except for me. V'chol asher yesh lo natan b'yadi, and he's given me everything. Right? V'lo chasach mimeni muma. He's kept nothing back from me. Ki im otach. Except for you, basher at ishto. You are the only person in this household. You're the only part of this household that I will not take from. In other words, he's viewing her as a part of the property of the master, which in Egyptian society makes a lot of sense. So I can't do it. How can I do this tremendous evil? V'chatati l'Elohim. And I will have transgressed to God. Which is a very strange thing to say to his master's Egyptian wife, who's a polytheist by definition. So he says to her, not only is it a logical problem for me, but it's a spiritual, religious, philosophical problem for me. Now look at this next verse. This is unbelievable. We're not looking at one isolated incident. We're not looking at, you know, he was there and she was interested. Vayehi kidabra el Yosef yom yom. Every day. And he doesn't listen to her, to sleep with her, to be with her. By the way, the Medrash tells us, and there is some reflection for this in the verse, you know, we're not talking about a 900-pound, she was very beautiful. And there is a certain logic to that. If you are the master, if you're the minister of Egypt, and you live in a society, and by the way, they were clearly not only a polytheistic society, they were a polygamistic society as well. In other words, they had many wives. And that seems to have been the norm in all societies in those days, by the way, up to a point including Judaism. So he could have any wife he wanted. So it makes sense that he would have picked a desirable woman. Although that doesn't suggest that it has to be so. And vayehi ki hayom hazeh, and then this day came. And he comes home, Joseph comes home to do his job. But this time there's nobody there. They're all alone. And she grabs him. She's got him. Sleep with me. She gives him an order. And he runs off, leaving the garment in her hand, right? He rips. And she calls the people of the household. Look, they brought this little Jewish guy, and he's laughing at us. Letzachek bi, to laugh with me, which also means to, he wants to have relations with me. Vayehi karimi koli vayekra, and so I cried out, because he tried to rape me. Vayazov bigdo etzli, and look, he even left his garment in my hand. Vayana sachutz, and he ran out. And then you can guess the rest of the story. The master hears the story, and he gets angry, and they put him in jail. Joseph understood full well the implications of what he was doing. This is an unbelievable story. You're alone. You're a slave. You've been abandoned by your family, abandoned by your father who loved you so much, because where's Jacob and how come he hasn't come to claim Joseph? And Jacob knew where Egypt was. Joseph doesn't necessarily know that Jacob doesn't know that he's been taken into slavery, because Abraham had two sons and one of them had to leave the house, Ishmael, and Isaac had two sons and one of them ends up being the non-desirable Esav, and maybe Joseph is now the non-desirable. And if you've been abandoned by your family, maybe you even feel you've been abandoned by your God, but Joseph doesn't feel abandoned by God somehow, even as a slave in Egypt. And he gets presented with this unbelievable opportunity. What is it that causes Joseph not to do it? What causes Joseph to be able to maintain his principle, as it were? And it's very interesting. This is the act that causes me to cause Joseph, to call Joseph a tzaddik. What does tzaddik mean? It comes from the word tzaddik. What's right? Sometimes it's not easy what's right. It's not easy to figure out. It comes from something deep inside. That we know something is right, and we know something is wrong. But we allow ourselves to be distracted. We have layers of obstacles, of physical self-gratification and spiritual self-gratification. And I let myself do all sorts of things, and I convince myself that really they're right, even though deep down sometimes, maybe, we know that something may not be so right. I sit on a bus and somebody gets up. And I know I should get up for that person. I know. But it's too easy not to. And all sorts of other examples. And Joseph doesn't. He says, if this is right, then that's what has to be. So now look again at this story. This is very interesting. First of all, look at the wording in verse 7. Vatisa eshet Adonav et einea el Yosef. Literally, she casts her eyes upon Joseph. Does the word vatisa remind you of anything? Lo tisa et shem Hashem alokecha lashav. You shall not take the Lord's name in vain. And we said that you have a life to live, and where you take that life is very much a function of what you do with the incredible potential that God gives you. We have a tendency to view sometimes these things. It's not my fault. I met a woman. She's married. I fell in love. I wish I'd never met her, but I fell in love. It's not my fault. Comes along the Torah and says, of course, the real question is, who controls whom? Does the man control the animal within, or does the animal control the man? And it's interesting that this whole story begins with her casting her eyes. It doesn't say she sees. It says she's looking. She's casting. She wants something. She's made a choice. It's also interesting that it says constantly, Shechva imi, sleep with me. The whole perception here, right, is ima. Look at verse 10. Lo shamayle lishkav etzla liyot ima, to sleep with her, to be with her. She never says, I want to be with you. It's always her wanting him to be with her. Because the act of adultery is essentially, as perceived in this story, to a certain extent, a selfish act. Because I put me ahead of someone else. It's also interesting to note, what does this remind you of? Joseph says an unbelievable thing. He says, my master has given me everything. And he's only withheld from me one thing. There's only one thing I can't do. What does this remind you of in the story of the book of Genesis? Yeah. That's exactly what happens. God says to Adam, Mikol eitz agan achol tochel, you can eat from any tree. Just this one tree don't eat from. You have the whole house. You have everyone. There's millions of women, millions of men you can find. But this one you can't have. But it's always the one we can't have that we want. In other words, the root of that divergence of path, almost between productive life and counterproductive life, between pain and pleasure, between the progression through mitzvot towards a relationship with God, and the divergence through sin away from God, is very much a function of this question. Can I overcome what I want in order to do what I need to do? And how often do we confuse want and need? And do we begin to assume that what we want is really what we need? I need her. It's interesting. Need in a relationship is something that becomes developed. It's not something you begin with. At this stage, I've developed a relationship with my wife that I need my wife. I don't know how I would survive. God forbid. So that's really what's going on here in this story. But there's one more important issue which relates to all the other commandments. What is Joseph saying here? It's such a weird discussion that Joseph is having. He's saying to Potiphar's wife, he says, you know, my master gave me everything. What does that have to do with anything? I mean, if adultery is wrong, then it's wrong. What Joseph is saying is that I have a certain obligation to my master. What is that obligation? What word comes to mind?
Respect.
If my master gives me everything, does that demand respect? Gratitude, right? Hakarat HaTov. Recognition of good. And the real root of my inability to adulter with his wife is a function not just of me considering it's wrong, but of the gratitude that I have to him. In fact, says the Talmud, says tradition, the root of transgression is denial of good, and the root of mitzvah is hakarat hatov, is recognition of good, which fits exactly with what we were saying yesterday. Why can't I murder another human being? Because I recognize how much I owe God for the life that God's given me. And that recognition, that gratitude is so great, how could I take another life? Yosef is so full of this tremendous gratitude to God. How could he take another wife? And that's why he puts in Elohim. See, if Adam and Eve were so filled with tremendous gratitude to God for all the trees they were given, then they wouldn't really have been capable of eating from the one tree that they weren't given. And that's very much a part of it. You know, when you think about it, it's an incredible thing. The way we're created and the way our bodies works. I remember just, you know, I had this tremendous car accident a couple of years ago. And I was in very difficult straits. And there were major issues that I had to deal with. You know, my spleen was ruptured and all my ribs were cracked and all this other stuff. And my knee was also hurt, you know. Both my knees were a little bruised. So eventually I got to the knees. You know, there were bigger issues and I went through all sorts of, you know, I was in the hospital and afterwards and whatever. And then I got to the stage of my knee. And I remember, you know, I went to this physiotherapist and I went to whatever. And I began to discover, because that's what they do. You go to an orthopedist or physiotherapist, the first thing they tell you is everything they can think of to tell you that they think you can possibly remember about the knee. Well, there's the meniscus, and there's the patella, and there's ligaments, and they cross each other, and there's, fluidity, schus, and cartilage, and all these different things, and it works this way, and you start to realize, this is an incredible thing, this knee. And they've tried to develop an artificial knee. And they're not capable, with all the science. They just can't get it exactly right. It's an incredible thing that there's skin and there's bone and there's something that isn't quite skin and isn't quite bone, and that's how the whole thing works. And there's a piece of bone that just rolls around in there and it all works. And every single movement that we make with our leg, every step we take, that knee has to do something like 150 different activities in a second so that everything works. And that's just the knee. I mean, never mind the brain. So think about all the different physical things that we do. The physical act of having a relationship with another being. So God could have said, look, here's what you have to do. You have a mitzvah. You take a woman and, you know, you hold her hand very hard for an hour and then you have a baby. I mean, God could have created us any way he wanted to. Biology could have developed. The fact that a man and a woman, in order to create a life physically, have to come together physically in such a manner that makes them as close physically as they can be, is symbolic of the fact that the creation of life should be a part of a relationship which brings them spiritually as close as they can be. That's what allows me to appreciate the life that's being created. That's the framework and the background that will give that life the ability to achieve the potential it has. It's a very difficult thing. The family in Judaism is very much one of the most important factors. There's no halachic obligation to have a family. When you think about it, there's an obligation to create life. But there's a mitzvah to have a divorce. And yet it's clearer than in the background. The stability of a family and what that family can give is a very important part of the Jewish communal experience. The stability of the family. And it all begins from my relationship with the family of one, me, and the family of two, me and God. And only then can I develop a relationship with the family of three, which is me, God, and the life partner that you can create a life with. And that's what's going on here in the world of Yosef. Yosef and Potiphar's wife are two different people and two different philosophies. One is a monotheist and the other is a polytheist. One is a slave and the other is a master. And they have two totally different agendas and totally different systems of goals. So how could they create a life together? How could they create a relationship together? They couldn't create it if it's supposed to be about giving. They could only do it if it's about taking. Comes along Yosef and says, I've been given so much from my master. How can I take? How can I view life through the prism of wanting to take? I view life through the prism of wanting to give. I wake up in the morning and I say, what can I give back to the world that gave me so much? What can I give back to God that gave me so much? What can I give back to my fellow human being that gave me so much? You know, if I go to a candy store, and I know my wife loves, you know, those yellow M&Ms. There's like two different possibilities in M&Ms. You got your brown bag M&Ms and your peanut, whatever, yellow bag M&Ms. So my wife loves the yellow bag M&Ms. So if I really have a deep relationship with my wife, then I want to give. And so if I see a bag of yellow M&Ms, I should automatically want to get it because I know it'll give her something. And if I don't get it, I have to have a good reason not to get it. But could you imagine walking by that yellow bag of M&Ms, knowing that your wife loves them and not going through that thought process? That's a part of your relationship. And how much more is that true on every other level? But if my relationship is about taking, then I've missed the boat. And I'll go you one further. Because ultimately, this whole system of Ten Commandments, which is an introduction to the larger picture of the mitzvot and everything that it does to create me as an ethical person and allow the world to become an ethical place. If my life becomes almost consumed by taking, it has to affect my ability to give. It has to. And if I'm involved in a relationship which has as its root taking, then that has to somehow spiritually, mystically affect my ability to give. So don't get me wrong. It doesn't mean that every adulterous relationship is only about taking. That's not true. But the root of the reason that adultery, in the Bible at least, is described as an objective problem is because somewhere in that mesh of an adulterous relationship has to be the concept of taking, of something selfish. And the challenge is to try at least to develop a relationship which has as its root giving, kindness. That's the real definition of relationship. And it's true with every relationship in Judaism. My relationship with another human being that allows me to become friends with them is because it's based on giving. Any relationship which is based on taking can't develop a friendship. If we have a quid pro quo, right? I get this from you and you get that from me and that's our relationship. How close can that relationship become? The only way that relationship can become close is if the whole balance changes. If it's not me taking something from you and therefore you taking something from me, but me giving something to you and therefore you giving back to me, then it can become a close relationship. And it's true in general, children as well. I can only develop a close relationship with my child if the root of my relationship is my wanting to give. If the root of my relationship is my wanting to take, it doesn't work. And if you look at all the different problems that children have with their parents, it most often stems from a feeling on the behalf of the child that they think that their parents want to take something from them. To take away their freedom to choose their profession, to take away their freedom to choose their partner, to take away their space, to take away... But if a child can sense how much the parent wants to give them, well, then it's difficult not to have a productive relationship. And vice versa. If you want to develop a close relationship with your parent, with your friend, with your spouse, All you have to do is two things. One, you have to make it about your giving, not dependent on your getting. And two, you have to focus your thoughts on what it is that your opposite is giving you. If you would think, how much can I give to my parent? And how much is my parent desiring to give me? Then you would have an amazing relationship with your parents. And that's the root of this problem of adultery. That's why there's a problem with idolatry. Because idolatry also, physical self-gratification is about taking. Power is about taking. And even, and I want to find an opportunity to understand this, but even fulfilling some sort of an emotional need can be very much about taking. I remember once, I had a woman, she came into my parents' house to meet with me when I was in New York, and she was just ripped apart. And she was a friend of a former student who I'd become close with because she'd come to a few classes of mine, whatever. Anyway, it turned out she'd been date raped. And it was a horrible, horrible story. She knew the guy. And the guy was, by his definition, obviously not by mine, a religious guy. And he was even in the same community. And they worked together. It was a very difficult situation. And she had gone out with him or whatever, and she wasn't sure, and he date raped her. And I, you know, we had made a meeting to sit for half an hour. You could imagine I canceled a couple other things. I sat with him. It must have been 4 or 5 hours. By the time we were finished having the discussion, it was like 1 in the morning, right? And I was a wreck. It was a Friday night. I was a wreck. I was completely destroyed. And I came to shul the next morning, and I was like, you know, I was just emotionally distraught, and I was just ripped apart, right? Because could you imagine this wonderful girl, beautiful girl, and this, someone could do that to her, and she was crying her eyes out, and she didn't know what to do, and how would she ever get married, and how would she ever get over this, and she has to go for therapy, but she has no money, and how she can deal with this, and she has to go back to work, and should she quit her job, and all these difficult questions. And I get to shul the next morning, I'm thinking, you know, I have to go talk to her, risking about this, and I have to think about what I'm going to do, and I'm going to deal with this. And this woman walks in like a daisy, just happy and wonderful, and life is great, and smiling. This was how I learned about transference, right? She had just transferred all of her problems, and God forbid that she did this consciously. She just took her whole baggage, and she gave it to me. She just dumped it. And she took from me, right? She took from me my perspective. So you can take emotional need, or you can give it very easily. And that's really the challenge. Can an adulterous relationship be about me wanting to give to someone? Or is somewhere at the root of it me wanting to take? And if I'm willing to make that kind of a commitment to someone, and she's willing to make that kind of a commitment to me, so we call that commitment marriage. And you can't make that commitment to two different people. So therefore, she has to divorce her husband and say, I can't give to you anymore. That's why we have to get divorced. That's the mitzvah of divorce. That I'm not in a stage anymore where I can give to you. And therefore we shouldn't be married. And I found someone else who I want to give to. And therefore we should be married. But if you're not willing to make that kind of commitment, then perhaps something at the root, you're not willing to let go of something else, is really about taking. That's the challenge of adultery. There's obviously a lot more to discuss on this topic. And I just want to say two quick things. First of all, I hope, you know, because you get sort of involved in the topic, that nobody assumes that what I'm saying is the be-all, end-all, that anybody assumes, God forbid, that I'm pontificating on what I consider to be relationships. You know, you have to, everybody has their perspective, and I'm just sharing with you mine, but, you know, you really have to think maybe there are things, you know, I'm young, and we have to think about this. And the other is that this type of a class should never be viewed as, you know, sort of a picture. Now I have a complete picture, and I can go and look at other pictures in the museum. This really is a class that has to whet your appetite. You know, because what is at the root of this commandment, and therefore if this is a two-word commandment, what is at the root of so many other words in the Bible? And tomorrow we will get, Bezrat Hashem, to the discussion of lying, and what really is lying, and is lying always bad, and what that means. So food for thought.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.